The National Broadcasting Company presents transcribed the American Forum of the Air, founded 22 years ago by Theodore Granick and dedicated to the full and public discussion of all sides of all issues, coming to you from Washington, D.C. Now, here is your moderator, Theodore Granick.
History records no more spectacular progress than that of the United States of America under the Constitution adopted more than 160 years ago. But with the growth of our material wealth, the increase in our population, and the development of our strength and influence throughout the world, there have come vast new responsibilities that could never have been anticipated by the framers of our Constitution. The demands upon our institutions of government, our courts, our congressional committees, and our executive departments are unprecedented and increasing. These problems have caused many thoughtful observers to ask the question, is the Constitution a modern instrument of government? On the eve of our Independence Day, the American Forum of the Air has asked two distinguished United States senators to answer this question. They are Senator Hubert H. Humphrey, Democrat of Minnesota, and Senator Carl E. Mundt, Republican of South Dakota. Would you care to take the question first, Senator Mundt?
I'll be glad to, Ted. I think it is especially fitting that we are discussing the topic, is the Constitution a modern instrument of government, on the eve of our national birthday, which we commemorate on July 4th, 1950. 47 years ago, at this very hour, the armies of the North and the South were arrayed against each other at Gettysburg in a mighty struggle which ended happily because we retained the unity and the strength of the Republic. In his Gettysburg address, Abraham Lincoln said 47 years ago as follows. 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty. That was in 1863. Today, in 1950, just exactly 47 years later, Americans are again locked in battle in far-off Korea and engaged in debate here at home to determine whether liberty and human freedom are to be the heritage of all Americans. Throughout the entire century and three-quarters of American history, the doctrines and stipulations of our American Constitution have served us well. They continue to serve us well today. In my opinion, our Constitution is not only a modern instrument of government, but it is vitally important that in this wicked world of governments in which too few men for too long a time have exercised too much power over too many people, that it is important we rededicate ourselves to the basic principles of our American Constitution. At home and abroad, there are those who clamor that because the Constitution is old and because liberty and freedom have never produced utopia, that the concept of big government and rulership by men should supplant the basic concept of limited government and rulership by law. And I hope that we will always retain the government by law American constitutional concept in this republic.
Senator Humphrey.
Well, I believe, Mr. Granick, that there's going to be very little heated argument tonight as to whether or not the Constitution is a modern instrument of government. I believe that it is. And I believe that it is primarily because the American people have had the intelligence to know that any document must be continually brought up to date so as to meet the new problems which face each and every generation. In fact, that was one of the purposes and objectives of the Founding Fathers. They provided in one of the articles of the Constitution for the amendment process. I think it's also important to know that this great Constitution of ours has stood us well because of a great political heritage. Oftentimes, our contemporaries feel that the Constitution was created in a rather quick and hurried manner, when in fact it represents the political thinking of some 3,000 years of recorded history. I always enjoyed a study of the Constitution, constitutional history, and constitutional law. I know that as we dig back into the history of our Constitution, we find that it's based upon some of the great principles of Aristotle and Socrates, the rule of reason, the fact that man is rational and capable of governing himself. More important, this Constitution of ours is based upon a great spiritual principle, upon the importance of the individual, recognizing man's humility before his God, and recognizing also that man was created in the image of his Maker. It's for that reason that the principle of government by the consent of the governed is such an important and all-embracing principle in constitutional government as we know it.
Senator Humphrey, should more specific language be included in the Constitution to restrict encroachment of the federal government upon the vested rights of the individual states?
No. As a matter of fact, I think one of the great virtues of our Constitution is that those who prepared it, who ratified and who wrote it and prepared its articles, recognized that broad principles should be laid down and that the minutiae, the details, should be excluded. I think that's a tribute, may I say, to the statesmanship and the great philosophical understanding of the men who attended the Constitutional Convention.
Senator Mundt?
I think that it's quite true that those broad principles are really part of the genius of our great American Constitution. And I'd like to say just a word or two about some of those broad principles, which it seems to me we must be very careful these days to continue and to protect. It seems to me that deeply embedded in the character of our Constitution are two great concepts, both involving the separation of powers. We're all pretty conversant with one of those concepts, and that is that there should be separation between the legislative, the executive, and the judiciary in the manifestation of the affairs of government. It seems to me equally important is the concept found in our Constitution over and over again that there should be a separation of the powers of the people insofar as their political and economic lives are concerned. I think the Constitution wisely dealt with the political affairs of men, retaining for the individual American the right to manage his own economic affairs. I think those are two important points in the principles of the Constitution, and I want to call a special attention to the fact that there is that separation, implied and expressed, between the economic and the political activities of the citizens of the United States.
Senator Humphrey.
I would like to develop a moment some of these basic principles that are involved in our Constitution. First of all, the preamble of the Constitution sets the theme of the entire constitutional system when it says, "We the people." Now, that's a very significant phrase. It's often memorized and mouthed and repeated in a sort of a routine manner. But "we the people" exemplifies what we call the principle of popular sovereignty. In other words, that all power rests with the people. And as I said, that goes back to a sort of the system of natural law, the principles of natural law, where all power is inherent in man, in by the very fact of his being. Now, the second principle that I'd like to point out is that the preamble of the Constitution gives us the answer to tonight's discussion. Is this a modern instrument? Because the preamble says, "We the people do in the present," not did or shall or will, but "we the people do in this day of July 1950. In every day of our lives, so that it's constantly up to date. And I think that the Founding Fathers knew exactly what they were doing when they put that contemporary, present language, that the Constitution is to be applied to the needs of the day, that it is to be developed and expanded in terms of the social, political, and economic environment of the time, as long as you don't, as my friend from South Dakota says, as long as you don't destroy the principle. And those principles, I should say, should be indestructible, and they surely should be protected.
Senator Mundt, Section 8 of the Constitution says that Congress shall have the power, quote, "to provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States." Does that give a constitutional justification for the welfare state, as much discussed?
No, I would think not, because there are 17 specific grants of power that the American states gave to the federal government. And in none of those was there anything which would indicate that it was the function of the federal government to provide the common welfare. It was to promote the common welfare, as is pointed out by Senator Humphrey in the preamble. And I think those that would impose some kind of socialism upon this country fail to recognize that our constitutional forefathers, rather wisely and looking a long way ahead, used the term that the people in the Constitution should promote the common welfare and not provide it.
Well, there surely wouldn't be any argument over the word as to whether or not it's promote or provide, because it surely is quite explicit in the Constitution. Nevertheless, I think it also should be noted that while the Constitution talks about promoting the general welfare, it has in the same phrase, without a semicolon or without a comma or a dash or any other method of setting out language, "and to secure the blessings of liberty for ourselves and our posterity," which indicates to me that the Founding Fathers, the great philosophers and teachers of constitutional government, saw nothing incompatible with the efforts of a government to promote, that is, to try to provide some of the conditions for the general welfare and to secure the blessings of liberty for ourselves and our posterity. This whole problem of the so-called welfare state, which is a tag, it's a name, is a matter of degree. It's a matter of emphasis. How far do you go? Now, I think both the senator from South Dakota and myself would agree that we do not believe in public ownership. I know he doesn't, and I know I don't.
That's correct.
I've never recommended what I consider to be nationalization of American industry. I believe the major job of American government is to try to protect those conditions in society that makes it possible for individual political liberty and individual economic freedom, thereby meaning the preservation of the institutions of private property as well as the preservation of the basic civil rights of our people. Civil liberties is a better word.
In that connection, Mr. Granick, I'd like to point out that John T. Flynn, in his very challenging and controversial book, The Road Ahead, which I presume all Americans have read by this time or should have read, points out very clearly on page 66 that if the government of the United States goes into the business of trying to provide the general welfare, it eliminates that separation of powers between the economic and political lives of men, which neither Senator Humphrey nor I want, because neither one of us want public ownership. And I think that's an important thing to point out, that if you go too far in the direction of providing for the needs of men, then you lose something pretty sacred in the minds of our forefathers, and I'm sure pretty sacred to both Senator Humphrey and myself.
I would make a comment, Mr. Granick, about Mr. Flynn. I've known of Mr. Flynn's writings and his works for some time. I will make merely this statement, that I think he's a rather poor student, both of economics, and a rather inept and poor student of political philosophy. I happen to believe that Mr. Flynn gets most of his observations from revelation, rather than from history or historical perspective. For example, Mr. Flynn does not seem to be able to disassociate between what one calls the politics and what one calls economics. The Constitution of the United States, at least a good portion of it, is directed towards what we call man's political liberties. His political liberties, to be sure, that portion which pertains to commerce and patent rights and copyrights pertains to his economic liberties. I think it is very, very definitely important that we remember that basically what man seeks is his own individual freedom. In other words, put first things first. And I happen to believe that a private property system is basically supported by a free political system, and that the free political system is of vital importance to the preservation of the institutions of economics. And I want to emphasize, if I may, that
I should fortify my position by quoting another authority in addition to John T. Flynn, since Senator Humphrey doesn't seem to recognize him or consider him as an authority.
I recognize him. He's an able writer. He's just a poor student of politics.
I think he's not only an able writer, but a very astute student of politics and economics, but that isn't the subject of the debate today. Let me quote then from a great Democrat, Grover Cleveland, who was in his inaugural address, March 4th, 1893, said, "The lessons of paternalism ought to be unlearned, and the better lesson taught, that while the people should patriotically and cheerfully support their government, its functions do not include the support of the people." So writing away back there, Grover Cleveland, who was a Democrat and must therefore have been a great student of politics and a great student of economics, said the same thing that John T. Flynn has said in The Road Ahead.
Well, I would say to my friend from South Dakota that Grover Cleveland is some 75 years from our existence, number one. And that, of course, has some difference, put some new perspective upon it. But more than that, let's get back to what he was really talking about. No one expects a government to be paternalistic. But since my friend from South Dakota quoted Abraham Lincoln, I would have him know that Abraham Lincoln said that a government was of the people, by the people, and for the people. The government is not a disinterested third party. This government is based upon the principle of government by the consent of governed. It's based upon the principle of majority rule. It's based not upon the principle of the state. The rights that the state had, they got from the people. And the Article 10 of the Constitution basically points out the importance of popular sovereignty, and the basic structure of our government is upon the will of the American people as they express it. Now, if the American people express their will through their elected representatives for a Social Security program, that's not paternalism, because the American people have voted that. And the Constitution is based upon the people, not upon a scrap of paper, not upon the judiciary, the legislative, or the executive, but based upon the will of the people as it is exemplified by the machinery and the mechanics of government, which are so well developed in the constitutional form.
Gentlemen, talking about government, Senator Munn, I'd like to ask this question of you.
All right.
Article 4, Section 4, states that the United States shall guarantee to every state in the Union a Republican form of government. How do you define a Republican form of government?
That's just one more reason why I'm so fond of the Constitution. I wish that it could have been as prophetic in that respect as it has in many others. Of course, I define a Republican form of government in one which there is representative government, one in which the people express their will through their representatives rather than the popular sovereignty idea just mentioned by Senator Humphrey, whereby, of course, they vote directly for the issues at stake.
May I take a question?
Well, may we make just a little comment. I was going to say to my friend from South Dakota that if it were not for the fact that the Constitution guaranteed a Republican form of government, I'm sure that the people would have Democrats in every state, you know, in every state legislature. But because of our great respect for the Constitution, we divide it up and give them a with a capital R. Now, not to be facetious.
I sometimes think myself that were it not for the Constitution, the Democrats would take over everything. I agree with you.
Let me just make this comment, Mr. Granick. Senator Mundt has said that the principle of popular sovereignty he looks upon as the principle of direct participation. Now, my friend knows that that's not the case. That is what we mean by popular election, or by the referendum, or by the direct ballot on each and every item of legislation. The principle of popular sovereignty is simply this, that all power rests in the people, that all power is inherent in the people, and that the only power supreme over the people is God Almighty himself. And that the people, in drawing up a constitution, have been willing to delegate certain powers, to release certain powers. So that you see, the basic principle in the Constitution is one of limited government and of delegated powers, but with all powers, as Article 10 of this Constitution says, the 10th Amendment, and I think it would be well to read the 10th Amendment, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively, or to the people. So you get right
implied
back to the first
in that,
principle.
Of course, implied in that, of course, is that the people express themselves through their state governments and not through the federal government on those things not delegated specifically in the 17 instances to the big central government.
There's no doubt about that.
Let's hear from the people. Let's take a question from one of the audience. Go ahead, sir.
My name is Mo Lerner. I operate the limousine service at the Washington National Airport. I'd like to address my question to Senator Humphrey, who incidentally is one of my valued customers.
Thank you.
Under the Constitution, Senator, under the Constitution, did the President have the legal right to order troops to Korea without first getting the approval of Congress?
I shall answer that question very briefly to tell you that in my view and in my understanding of the Constitution, according to Article 2 of the Constitution, the President not only had that right, but he had that responsibility. He had that great duty. Because the President of the United States takes an oath of office, and one of the things that he takes as a member of the government is to be Commander-in-Chief of the Army and the Navy and the militia of the several states, and when called in the actual service of the United States, and also that he shall at all times protect the general welfare and protect the sovereignty of our nation and the security. And I would even develop it to point out that the history of this country is resplendent with such examples. For example, we have used the troops of our nation in such instances in Nicaragua and Haiti. We used the troops in the border raids, as you recall, in 1916 with Pancho Villa in Mexico. We've used the troops of our country in the Boxer Rebellion, which was in China. We used them at the time of the Pirates of Tripoli. We've used them repeatedly because what the President is obligated to do under the Constitution is to protect the security of this land and the security of America and the security of persons in our armed services and other citizens of the United States.
Senator Mundt, would you care to comment on the question?
Well, I have no desire to question, of course, the constitutionality of the actions that the President has taken in connection with the Korean crisis, but I think I know what the young man who asked the question had in mind. Like him, I am distressed by the fact that in the general area of foreign policy, it seems that the United States Congress and the Senate are becoming less and less important, getting consulted less and less, and that we come into the picture after the fact has been achieved. For example, if should, God forbid, the President's action in Korea and the situation there develop into a situation from which war eventuates, we would have a situation in which war was virtually declared by executive action rather than by the subsequent action of Congress. It's one of those things which, because the world is getting smaller, because we don't have the precedent on which to build it, we find Congress and the people being consulted less and less and less in the field of foreign policy. And in that extent, we are growing alarmingly to the same section and the same degree that people in totalitarian countries are in foreign policy.
Well, I, of course, must take exception with that remark because the basis of the American constitutional system under which our president operates is entirely different than that of a totalitarian power. This same president is elected. He can be defeated. This same president can be impeached, if need be, by the members of the Congress of the United States. There are all kinds of legal protections.
Protections, of course, but in reality, nobody would contemplate impeaching a president in the middle of a war. While it's legally possible, from all realistic standpoints, we find ourselves, as a people, moving in foreign policy much as the people of Germany moved in foreign policy under Hitler?
Well, of course...
Or is it move in Spain under Franco? The decisions are made by the executive, and the people, if consulted at all, are consulted like the members of the Reichstag were in Berlin or in Germany on September 1st, 1939, when Hitler said, I have moved my troops into Danzig. Now, as I say, I'm not going to quarrel about the constitutionality of it, but we might as well face up that in the field of foreign policy, democracy is not functioning with near the virility that it does, for example, under the parliamentary system of Great Britain.
Well, I think that we can well recognize the parliamentary system of Great Britain is more responsive to individual, to present-day or current-day needs. But I want my friend from South Dakota to know that under Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution, the president is expressly directed to take charge of foreign policy, only with the advice and consent of the Senate, which follows after, if you please, the direction, the mandate that the president be in charge of treaties and foreign policy. He is under the Constitution permitted to establish, in fact, authorized to establish the Secretary of State.
Of course, you can't read into that anything which gives to the president the right to involve the country in war without action of Congress.
May I take another question? Go ahead, sir.
I'd like to direct this question to Senator Munn. My name is George Sterling, and I happen to be also in the automobile business. Senator, since members of Congress also take an oath to defend the Constitution just as members of the Supreme Court, why should the Supreme Court have the superior power over the Congress and the right to declare a statute invalid because of the court's constitutional interpretation?
That's an interesting ramification in our constitutional process, because actually in the American Constitution, the United States Supreme Court is not given that right expressly any place. They have derived it because in the Constitution it says that Congress shall have the right to pass laws in pursuance with the Constitution. And so it was found eventually they had to have somebody as an umpire or as a referee in the contest, and the Supreme Court stepped into that vacuum and gradually, by precedent and by practice, has assumed more and more authority in that connection.
I'd just like to point out a little historical background on that. At the time of the colonial legislatures, by the way, in the early days of American colonial life, we had a good deal of self-government. And may I say to my friend from South Dakota, the legislatures used to make it tough then for the governors, like sometimes the Congress and the legislatures today make it a little rough for presidents and for governors.
And vice versa.
And vice versa. Only in the other, back in the legislative, in the colonial days, it wasn't so much vice, it was mostly versa.
Yeah. I agree, it's more vice than now.
The legislature at that time could pass a law, and then what was known as the Privy Council in the British Empire, the Council, King's Council, would review that law as to whether or not it was within the framework of the British imperial system and within the framework of the British Constitution. Now, that's part of the background of judicial review. I happen to believe that the courts have become the protectors, in a great sense, of liberties, of our liberties. Which is not too good a comment, by the way, upon some of the congressional processes.
May I take a question from the young lady there, please? Go ahead, ma'am.
My name is Judith Knight. My question is for Senator Humphreys. Do you think some type of amendment would furnish more adequate support to the United Nations?
Well, I happen to believe that if we wish to amend the Charter of the United Nations so as to establish international law and a modicum of world government over certain areas, such as the control over the instruments of mass destruction, to yield a portion of our sovereignty insofar as the making, let's say, of treaties or the making of common defense agreements, that we possibly would have to amend the Constitution. However, there is surely nothing within the Constitution at the present time that prohibits our active participation in the United Nations. Nor is there anything in the Constitution at the present time that would prohibit our pooling some of our military resources for the purposes of an international police force. However, if we were going to go further, let me say, if we were going to go to a point where we would deny the Congress of the United States the right to declare war, or to deny the President of the United States the right to use our armed forces in the protection of the security of the country, and then we would have to amend the Constitution, and may I say I would insist upon it as one member of the legislature.
Sorry, gentlemen, time for summaries. Your summary, Senator Mundt.
Well, I would like to summarize simply by stating that I think it's important that all of us as Americans recognize the point that I tried to stress in my opening remark. And that is, if we're going to remain free, if we're going to continue to have these great liberties which are so typically American today, it's tremendously important that all Americans recognize that the separability in the Constitution goes not only to the political aspects, that you have the separation of powers not only among the executive, legislative, and judicial branches of government, but we must keep separate also the economic and the political functions of the people. Because once government, per se, starts operating economic enterprises, starts mingling the economy of the country into the politics of the country, we wind up in some kind of totalitarian state. History has disclosed that time and time again all over the world. And only those countries remain free in which the people themselves are permitted to conduct their economic enterprises under proper rules of the game established by the Congress and made acceptable by the government. And so our Constitution today stands us in good stead as it always has, a modern instrument of government, provided we keep it that way.
Thank you, Senator Munn. Senator Humphrey, your summary, please.
I would place my emphasis in the summary upon the fact that the Constitution of the United States is based upon the principle of majority rule and respect for minority rights. The Constitution is an expanding document. It is contracts, it expands, it's able to meet the needs of our time by judicial interpretation, by the laws of the land as laid down by the Congress and the decisions as made by the executive branch of government. I would point out to my friends, and particularly my colleague from South Dakota, that the politics of a people and their economics are one and inseparable. But basically, the basic problem and the basic, let me say, the basic principle of a constitutional system based upon majority rule is the political freedom of the people, the rights of the people to participate in government, the rights of the people to share in government, to be governed only by the consent of the governed. And more than that, that whatever the rule of the majority may be, that it must be respected. And that if the majority does rule, if the processes of government and of election are protected, no one can call the government dictatorial. No one can say that the will of the people has been abrogated.
Thank you, gentlemen. You have been listening to a discussion, Is the Constitution a Modern Instrument of Government? Our speakers have been Senator Hubert H. Humphrey, Democrat of Minnesota, and Senator Carl E. Mundt, Republican of South Dakota. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
For reprints of this discussion, Is the Constitution a Modern Instrument of Government? Send 10 cents to Ransdell Incorporated, Printers and Publishers, Washington, 18, D.C. That's 10 cents to R-A-N-S-D-E-L-L, Ransdell Incorporated, Washington, 18, D.C. Join us again next week at this same time, ladies and gentlemen, for a discussion on the vital question, Do we need a new foreign policy? Our speakers will be Senator William Benton, Democrat of Connecticut, and Senator George W. Malone, Republican of Nevada. Our speakers again today have been Senator Hubert H. Humphrey, Democrat of Minnesota, and Senator Carl E. Mundt, Republican of South Dakota.